countries, particularly in Kuwait, there is a shift in consumer behavior toward more regional products, and particularly the one from Iran, from other GCC countries, which is why the public in Kuwait is shifting into buying more products that are not associated in any way possible with the United States or Britain. This is Farah Al-Hashim, Kuwait City, from Al Jabriya area.
As the Pakistan Super League kicks off for its highly anticipated cricket matches, an unexpected controversy has emerged, leading to widespread calls for a boycott among Pakistani fans.
Oh, that is clear of all fielders.
The uproar stems from KFC's association as a sponsor of the tournament, with critics citing the fast food chain's American roots and linking it to the United States' support for Israel's onslaught on Gaza.
We condemn KFC as a sponsor of our national cricket event. KFC represents a company with ties to Israel. Israel is involved in the killing of thousands of innocent men, women, and children in Gaza.
Meanwhile, activists are pushing to boycott the event, urging fellow Pakistanis to refrain from attending matches in person and instead watch the games online from the comfort of their homes. The move not only expresses dissent, but also hits the tournament organizers where it hurts the most, their ticket sales and on-ground merchandise purchases.
I am part of the boycott movement because I believe it's important to stand up for the people of Gaza. By watching online, I am not contributing to the ticket sales or on the on-ground merchandise purchases, which are the main sources of revenue for the organizers. It's a way of hitting them where it hurts.
Usually we would go to the ground, but this year I think a lot of even cricket fanatics have chosen not to just because they want to boycott KFC as their main sponsor. But me personally, I've been skipping a lot of matches as well, because we need to show solidarity for Gaza and stick with our brothers and sisters. I think that's more important.
Social media platforms have been flooded with hashtags such as hashtag boycott PSL and hashtag no to KFC as disillusioned fans express their discontent over what they perceive as an endorsement of American policies that they vehemently oppose.
The widespread boycott of an international cricket tournament by the passionate cricket-loving nation of Pakistan not only signals solidarity with the people of Gaza, but also serves as a powerful expression of discontent towards the businesses associated with the U.S. and Israel. Nasik Azmi, Islamabad.
In yet another rally to support the Palestinians in Gaza Strip, thousands of Yemenis have filled the streets of the capital Sana'a and other major cities. They chanted slogans supporting Palestinian resistance and condemned the Arab world's indifference toward Israeli atrocities in Gaza.
The Yemeni people were raised since their childhood to love and adore Palestine and to love jihad in Palestine. Therefore, when the opportunity arose to have an influential position under the leadership of Ansarullah, they did not hesitate and went out to the streets, believing that their protests were jihad for the sake of God, as the least duty as long as the borders were not open for them, and they were not able to fight with the Palestinians.
A message to the European peoples. Your governments today are contributing to genocide against the Palestinian people in Gaza by submitting to America's orders to militarize the Red Sea. America involves you in its own problems. The solution to stopping the Red Sea operations is to stop the aggression against Gaza and lift the siege. This is the easiest solution. But if your government wants to submit to America's orders, you will see what we will teach. You will see that we will teach America a lesson that will never forget. And if you attack us, you will unfortunately meet the same fate.
Protesters praised the recent operations by the Yemeni army, including the sinking of a British vessel in the Gulf of Aden. They also celebrated the introduction of the submarine weapon into the Yemeni army's arsenal, believing it will enhance the success of Yemen's naval operations.
The submarines introduced by Abdul Malik al-Houthi are one of the surprises that the enemy is going to face if it continues its aggression against Gaza. The Yemeni armed forces, specifically the Yemeni Navy, still have surprises coming, a wide range of targets, and also a superior ability to obtain information at any time and place. Therefore, these are successive military messages, the content of which is that we will escalate further as long as Israel's war in Gaza continues, and Yemen has the upper hand in its waters, and this position will never change.
Earlier, the spokesman of the Yemeni army announced that they have successfully carried out three military operations. The first operation involved launching multiple ballistic missiles and drones against various targets in Eilat-occupied Palestine. The other two attacks targeted an American destroyer and the British vessel Islander in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden. He added that the British ship was set on fire as a result of the attack.
Every Friday, people gather here affirming that they will never tire of taking to the streets to show support for the oppressed people of Palestine as long as the Israeli genocidal war on Gaza continues. They believe it is the least that all Muslims around the world should do as a religious duty toward the innocent civilians of Palestine. Abdulatif al-Washali, Sana'a.
On Thursday, the International Court of Justice held its fourth day of hearings on the legal consequences of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories since 1967. The case was prompted by the UN General Assembly in December 2022, when the international organization passed a resolution requesting an advisory opinion from the ICJ on Israel's policies and practices in the West Bank and in East Al-Quds, with a focus on the legal consequences arising from depriving the Palestinians from self-determination. 52 nations and three organizations, namely the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, the Arab League, and African Union, are taking part in the hearings.
Well, I think what we're witnessing today is a public trial. Country after country is exposing the evilness of occupation, is showing the tremendous violation of human rights that occupation continues to commit day in and day out, and it's also addressing the inhumane barbaric war that Israel continues to bring upon Gaza.
Iran and China were among those countries addressing the ICJ hearing on Thursday.
The UNGA Resolution 3070 of 1973, I quote, reaffirms the legitimacy of the people's struggle for liberation from colonial and foreign domination and alien subjugation by all available means, including armed struggle.
As our Supreme Leader said, the calamity of Gaza is the calamity of humanity and international community as a whole. Therefore, each and every state and relevant international organization has its own legal and moral responsibility to act urgently and decisively to prevent the ongoing crimes of Israeli regime in Gaza Strip.
Outside the court, braving the Hague's cold temperature, tens of people from across the Netherlands held a demonstration in solidarity with Palestinians.
I personally believe that the fact that it's not legally binding doesn't matter. I don't think this court case is necessarily going to be the direct reason that the Palestinian people will be liberated. I think it will be the pressure on our governments and international community that will hopefully make justice prevail.
Millions of people across the world are watching this case at the International Court of Justice. They are hoping that their faith in an international law-based system can be finally restored after decades of Israel subjecting the Palestinians to discrimination, apartheid, and deadly military force and evading accountability. Max Civili, The Hague.
In response to the European Union's naval mission in the Red Sea, Yemen's Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs Hossein Al-Azzi held a press conference addressing Yemen's stance on the tensions in the region. He urged EU members to withdraw their warships from the Red Sea, emphasizing that militarization of the region will only escalate the conflict.
Certainly, we will deal with any country who engages in hostilities against us, and we will deal with it as we dealt with the US and the UK. We are keen to treat everyone equally and will never allow the European Union or others to attack Yemen without getting a firm response. Whoever harms Yemen, we will harm him severely.
Al-Azzi noted that since the start of the Yemeni army's naval operations, over 5,000 vessels, including European ones, have safely passed through the Bab al-Mandab Strait after coordinating with Yemeni authorities. He also reaffirmed the safety of international maritime navigation for the entire world except for those who carry out hostile actions against Yemen.
The recent move by France targeting Yemeni drones is up for discussion. We have serious questions regarding the matter, and we expect Paris to provide us with reasonable explanation. If France does not apologize, and we are certain that Paris is following the British and American approach, we will respond because we have the right to self-defense. What is being practiced against American and British ships is due to their aggression against our country and their complicity in the ongoing genocide in Gaza.
Yemeni army has not targeted any European ships in its recent operations in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden. However, the European Union has launched the naval mission Aspides to counter potential attacks on American, British and Israeli-linked vessels.
Observers believe that the U.S. is dragging European countries into a direct war with the Yemeni army to protect its own interests in the region. They assert that an EU military intervention will impact the shipping of food and fuel to Europe, thereby destabilizing European countries. Al-Latif Al-Washali, Sanaa.
Julian Assange's many and vocal supporters out in numbers again as the WikiLeaks founder's extradition hearing resumes. Locked up in the high-security Belmarsh jail on the edge of London since 2019, Assange didn't attend the hearing because of his poor health. In one sense, the argument has not changed. The U.S. claims he's guilty of spying and wants him to face a court in the States. His backers say his case is a threat both to the rule of law and to the very foundation of proper journalism.
It would have a devastating blow to journalism worldwide. If an Australian journalist that is publishing in Europe can be imprisoned in the United States, not a single journalist anywhere in the world is safe. So this is the reason why all major press freedom organizations, human rights organizations, freedom of speech organizations in the world are rallying behind Julian, because they recognize the seriousness of the implication of this case if it goes ahead.
Over the years, Assange's case has attracted a lot of attention, most recently from his native Australia, a U.S. ally. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese and his cabinet ministers were among those who backed a parliamentary motion introduced by independent Andrew Wilkie, calling for Assange to be returned home.
The Australian Parliament, at least, is muscling up a little and prepared to be a little bit more assertive with Washington, at least on the Assange issue, and that's a good thing. That's Australia growing up a little. And maybe it will have some influence in Washington and help to get a political resolution to this.
It's been long since WikiLeaks published evidence of American forces attacking journalists and other innocent people in Iraq, evidence that in another context would have been applauded as the uncovering of war crimes in the interest of the public.
The fundamental question here is, how can countries that lecture the world on all kinds of freedoms criminalize investigative journalism?
A final decision is yet to come, but if the judges decide in favor of the U.S., Assange's only remaining recourse to avoid extradition would be the European Court of Human Rights. Saeed Purza, London.
Shoppers at the popular Wuse market in Abuja, the Nigerian capital, are having tough times as skyrocketing rise in the prices of commodities has taken a heavy toll on ordinary people. Prices of commodities, especially food items, have gone up more than 100%, and indeed, they've continued to rise on a daily basis.
Cost of living is something else. It's terrible. A common man with a salary of 30,000 cannot buy a bag of rice of almost 80,000 naira.
There is hunger, terrible hunger, and high rise of stealing, thief, everything just keep going higher.
Bag of cement It's like about 9,000, he just bought it. I said, wow, 9,000, where are we going? Bag of rice, 77,000.
Experts say, apart from the economic policy of devaluing the Nigerian currency, removal of multiple exchange rate windows has further weakened the naira against the dollar, resulting in inflation and harsh economic woes to the people. They said grinding poverty has created a sense of hopelessness in an already impoverished population, pushing many people to the edge.
IMF said we should devalue, we are devaluing. But what are the consequences of this on the economy, on the purchasing power parity that has even existed before now? We made money during the windfall when oil was at the price of oil was at its peak in the international oil market. But what did we do with this humongous amount that we made? It was frittered away through corruption.
Experts also said, at inception on 29 May 2023, the new government in Nigeria removed the subsidy on petrol, which pushed the prices of petrol up, resulting in the rise of goods and services, which further made things worse for the poor in Nigeria. But they said there are immediate solutions that can bring relief.
Nigeria is for Nigerians, so every Nigerian should benefit. So if the people want subsidy, they should reinstate that very particular subsidy. Or we fix our refineries. It's even dubious that today we are producing oil, but we subject the sales of our oil to American dollar, price them in dollar.
Pockets of protests over the economic hardship have started springing up in some Nigerian cities. Meanwhile, the Nigerian Labour Congress has called for a two-day nationwide strike on 27 and 28 February in protest over the rising cost of living.
The Nigerian government has promised to take proactive steps to mitigate the economic problems people are facing. Experts, however, say the government should first solve the persistent insecurity in Nigeria to be able to focus on agriculture for food security. They also say human capacity must be developed so that the Nigerian population becomes an asset instead of a liability. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. From the point of view of the Islamic Republic of Iran's constitution. The right to vote and the right to determine one's fate are among the fundamental rights highlighted in the Constitution of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Basically, people's rights are pivotal issues emphasized in political systems of many countries. Chapter 3 of Iran's Constitution, 2, is about the rights of the nation. A variety of rights of people and their social freedoms and their boundaries are mentioned in this chapter. Stay with us to review the rights and freedoms clarified in this chapter. rights named in Chapter 3 of Iran's constitution are as follows. The right of equality before the law for all regardless of their skin color, race and language. Equal support for men and women to enjoy all human, political, economic and cultural rights while observing Islamic codes. The right to enjoy judicial security and immunity. Prevention of torture, banning of desecration and harassment. The right of freedom of expression, writing and press within the boundaries mentioned in Islam. The right to enjoy group freedom such as formation of parties, political and vocational associations and holding of rallies. The right of intellectual and ideological freedoms and banning of inquisition. The right to choose your job, the right to enjoy social security, the right to enjoy free education, the right to have a house in proportion with one's needs, the right to choose place of residence, the right to a lawsuit, to refer to qualified court, and choosing a lawyer. The Constitution of the Islamic Republic of Iran has specified political principles, structures, hierarchies, status, and boundaries of government while determining the rights of citizens. This constitution has cast a special look at the right to elect and determine officials and national fate. According to Article 6 of the Constitution of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the affairs of the country are run relying on public votes. This article stresses that people's participation in is practiced via elections or referendums, including election of the president, members of the majlis or the parliament, and city and village councils. Accordingly, the system of elections in Iran, the two key officials of the Islamic Republic, namely the leader of the Islamic Revolution and the president of the Islamic Republic of Iran, are elected with people's direct and indirect votes respectively. The Islamic Council Assembly or the majlis and the assembly of experts are also formed by direct votes of the people. The majlis is almost the same as parliament in many countries, while the assembly of experts, which has a term of 8 years, has the duty of supervising the performance of the leader of the Islamic Revolution and appointment of a new one in the case of need. According to Article 107 of Iran's constitution, the determination of the leader is the duty of the Assembly of Experts. In view of this, the members of the Assembly of Experts consult about all jurisprudence, whose qualifications are accepted according to Article 5 and 109, and choose the best one fitting with the qualifications. Article 111 of the Constitution mentions supervision on leadership as another duty of the Assembly of Experts. Accordingly, this body continuously supervises the leader's performance in various spheres. It is explicated that whenever the leader fails to fulfill his duties or lacks one of the conditions for leadership, the Assembly of Experts dismisses him. Another manifestation of administration of the affairs of country by people is the aforementioned majlis or parliament. The majlis is the lawmaking branch of power. The lawmakers are elected for 4 years by the Iranian people. Considering the role and status of people in administration of affairs of the country, according to Article 69 of Iran's constitution, the sessions of the majlis should be public and the complete report of the debates should be published via official television and radio. Yet, for security reasons in special circumstances, closed sessions of the parliament are held. The ratifications of closed sessions are valid only in the presence of the members of the Guardian Council, while they receive 3 to 4 of the votes of members. The reports and ratifications of these sessions are released to the public after removal of emergency conditions. Article 69 of Iran's constitution is in fact a protector of people's status in administration of the country's affairs. Accordingly, each and every one of the nation should be informed of the issues and ratifications of the debates of the Majlis in detail. Another duty of the Iranian parliament, the Majlis, is to approve or disapprove the ministers proposed by the president. The parliamentarians can also impeach the members of the cabinet. Article 86 of the Constitution reiterates that lawmakers are quite free to express their views and cannot be judicially prosecuted for what they say at the Parliament in the position of a lawmaker. This article implies that a legislator in the Islamic Republic of Iran is completely free to defend people's rights and national interests, and there is no judicial confinement for him or her. The Islamic Republic has just witnessed the presence of tens of millions of people in the 45th anniversary of the glorious victory of the Islamic Revolution. Now people are getting prepared for holding another round of parliamentary elections and elections to the Assembly of Experts. These elections will be held on 1st of March. People proved in their celebrations on 11th of February that what they are committed to, the values and achievements of the revolution, in spite of all barriers and problems.
Doing a sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
As the Israeli regime continues its onslaught in the Gaza Strip, there's a massive increase on all fronts, from the death toll, which has reached almost 30,000, to the cost of the aggression itself, which has cost the Israeli economy massively. There's also the steadfast support that Palestinians have been getting from Hezbollah to Yemen to the resistance forces in the West Asia region. Meanwhile, deliberations at ICJ at The Hague are highlighting the illegality of Israel's occupation and apartheid practices on occupied Palestinian land. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how the Israeli regime has been defeated on so many fronts, from the battlefield to its economy and even its international standing, no matter how hard the U.S. has supported this illegal regime, while support for Palestinians and the resistance has only increased. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the program. Steve Bell, activist at Stop the War Coalition, and joins us from Coventry in the U.K. Also joining us is Masoud Shajara, chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, who joins us here in the capital, Tehran. Okay, great. Welcome to you both, gentlemen. Steve Bell, let me first start with you. We're looking at regional resistance groups that are unified in the position when it comes to the Israeli regime and obviously in support for the Palestinians. I'm going to start out with Hezbollah, which has been militarily engaged with the Israeli regime on an almost daily basis, if not on a daily basis. I'm wondering as to why it is that Israel wants to continue this targeting of Hezbollah and in turn Lebanon in this form and manner on a daily basis while it's carrying out its U.S.-Israeli genocidal war on the Gaza Strip?
Well, I think the reason it is doing so is because it wants to extend the war because it hopes to draw in the United States. It's not actually in a position, for example, to invade Lebanon at the moment, but it is in a position to act in a provocative manner. And for the Netanyahu government, anything which extends the war and involves the United States means that there is less likelihood of his own domestic weakness coming into play. So I think that that's why, for the Israeli government, it's a case of maintaining the dynamic that it has established in Palestine, and it wants to further involve the United States by provocations in the north.
Well, taking a look at another country here, and that's Yemen, Master Shajar, we just had an announcement that they had targeted another UK vessel. Of course, that's being construed in the public domain out, mainly Western ones, that here you have a violent entity that's executing violent actions in the Red Sea and affecting the world economy. But at the core of this, the only reason is for the carnage and the genocidal war in the Gaza Strip. They actually have announced that they will use advanced weaponry, even submarines, in order to, because there's nobody else doing anything to stop this war. I mean, that's what the Yemeni army is doing. What do you make of the steadfast support that they're giving the Palestinians? And in turn, why do you think the U.S. and the U.K. are targeting them? Because we know the U.S. has actually targeted Yemen along with the U.K. On several occasions inside the country.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, the core heart of this matter is sort of apartheid, genocidal, system of apartheid sort of occupied Palestine regime. The reality is that the regime of apartheid and genocidal action, it needs conflict. It cannot survive within harmony. So it needs to create conflict. It needs to create fear. It needs to create fear among its own supporters to justify themselves, the regime and people, to behave in this sort of barbaric way. And then when that has happened, that is unleashed, their supporters, be it United States or European governments, coming, aiding this genocide. And, you know, we see what we are seeing, we are witnessing day in, day out. Now, at the same time, there are those from axes of resistance who have risen up to stop this genocide, to make it difficult, to make a statement, to take action, be it sort of Lebanese resistance or be it the resistance in occupied Palestine or in Iraq or in Syria or in Yemen. What is really shocking is why isn't anyone else standing up doing what international community needs to do under its commitment, standing against genocide. Genocide that we haven't experienced in our lifetimes in the way that we are doing day in, day out, in front of our television, the death and destruction being brought to innocent people, men, women, and children. It's unbelievable. And the question is not why Yemenis have risen up to their responsibility to stand and do what they can against this genocide, to stop this genocide. The question really should be asked, why isn't anybody else doing anything? And indeed, why are they supporting the genocide rather than trying to stop it?
Well, that's the whole thing. This direct action needs to be put under the microscope here. I mean, you belong, Steve Bell, to Stop the War Coalition. And you guys have been active in terms of the different causes throughout the years. And really kudos to you, because I know you've been involved with the as an organizational piece behind some of the largest European protests in solidarity with the Palestinians. We spoke earlier in the news to somebody from Palestine Action. And we're looking at how this has become politicized when we look at, for example, what happened in Parliament when it comes to the SNP making an announcement for immediate ceasefire, but the Labour and the Conservatives have proposed amendments. Isn't that politicizing an issue that needs to really take a look at what's happening in order to prevent it? Direct action. What do you think should be done in terms of that in that regard?
Well, I think that there are many forms of action that aid the Palestinians, and certainly organizing demonstrations, mass demonstrations, is an important aid to the Palestinians. It creates enormous pressure upon governments, and that in turn reflects itself in pressure upon the United States government, which is, after all, the decisive government in this. If they wanted to, they could stop this war tomorrow simply by cutting off aid and arms to Israel. They're not about to do that. So the mobilizations that have taken place in Britain and, of course, throughout the world have been of great assistance. And their expression of this is that in today's times, for example, a most recent poll indicates that 66% of the British public support a ceasefire, and 61% believe that Israel should enter into peace negotiations with Hamas. This is despite the bipartisan position in Parliament against such a stance. So I think that the mobilisation, that there are a whole range of tactics and activity which people take part in, and all of these add weight to this international movement of solidarity with the Palestinians.
Well, since you mentioned the US, we need to talk about that, Master Shajara. Maybe you can maybe you can lead me as to where and how and to, in what respect we should talk about the U.S., because we are looking at the entity that has actually been able to help Israel continue to do what it's done throughout the years and decades, something that has been discussed in the ICJ. This is costing Joe Biden, though putting genocide next to Joe Biden's political career, I think, is wrong. But isn't that making an impact, however, this people power, like in the U.S. and even in the U.K. and maybe other countries?
Yeah, I think really one has to really appreciate, and I don't want to belittle the civil society and the ordinary people, be it in Britain, Europe, or in the United States, bravely have come out in support of Palestinians and against genocide. This is fantastic. But having said that, I think on the other side, we are seeing that the international institutions are almost, you know, bankrupt. They are really, it are not fit for purpose. And indeed, the democracy, be it in Europe or be it in the United States, is actually bankrupt. Overwhelming majority of people in the West, let alone around the world, are for immediate ceasefire. And then those who claim to be the voices and the will of the people, i.e. the sort of the establishment, are supporting genocide. And, you know, this is outrageous. I mean, really what we are seeing is a damnation of humanity and a damnation of the policies of so-called democracy. And what we are seeing is sort of a dictatorship of those who are in power are not going according to wishes of the majority or indeed the interest of the majority. There is no political, social, economical benefit for United States or Europe to support this genocide. This genocide brings no benefit to anyone, to any citizen around the world. But the fact of the matter is that these so-called democratic dictators are pursuing the genocidal policy against international law, against the wishes of their majority, and it's really brave of many people from different backgrounds, from Muslim community, Christian community, the Jewish community in very large numbers,
right,
and indeed people of all belief and none, coming together and vigorously supporting to try to stop this genocide. But I think we need to really evaluate what has gone wrong with our systems, that our systems are set and fixed to support genocide, despite the fact that the majority of citizens want immediate ceasefire.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, is there something wrong with the system? For example, Steve Bell, is there something wrong with the UN that has brought the ICJ, the highest court, into the picture? You have 53 countries. You have all of them coming out making deliberations, and all of them are criticizing and opposing the way that Israel has conducted itself in terms of human rights violations and in terms of just an apartheid regime to the max, almost. First of all, what do you make of the fact that that has happened? And obviously Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has totally dismissed any of the statements that have been made and leveled against Israel.
Well, firstly, it is evident that the global majority, both expressed through the United Nations and in the activity of people around the world, the global majority is with the Palestinians and demands justice and peace for the Palestinians. However, the institutions reflect the balance of forces in the world, the fact that the United States is the most powerful state, has a military budget 11 times higher than most other states, and is the reason that it's able to exert that power in support of Israel at this point in time. That's why there isn't a solution, because the United States, having registered a serious setback in Ukraine 2 years after supporting the a war against Russia, it basically has failed to break through and is having to face a de facto partition of that country. Having failed there, the United States is doubling down in support of Israel. That's why we've had three vetoes in the UN. That's why it's apparently making no serious efforts to restrain Israel. Of course, it does not agree with a lot of what Netanyahu is doing, but at the moment it isn't applying sufficient pressure because of Biden is weak and he's concerned about losing his presidency. However, the reality is that the failure of the international institutions is a reflection of the real weight of power in the world today, which doesn't unfortunately reside in the United Nations, but does reside in the force majeure of the United States leading a number of other nations who represent a minority in the world still.
Well, I guess there, Mr. Shedra talks about the U.S., how the president is somewhat weak and maybe can't exert pressure on Israel. But there's the other point of view where the U.S. is playing a double game here. Out in the public, it's saying we're going to do our best, we're going to see what we can do, etc. There's a peace, there are peace talks that are happening in Egypt, and the U.S. is there. But at the same time, I see you shaking your head, so I'm just going to let you go ahead.
Look, let us be frank. You know, this is not an exceptional time that is exceptionally we're going down this route because of a weak president, etc., etc. The fact is this, that our international institutions have failed to stop all genocide and all genocidal acts. You know, Bosnia, Rwanda, what happened in Afghanistan, what happened in Iraq, what happened in Syria, what happened in Libya. You know, it really has been not fit for the purpose. If at this particular time, when we are seeing genocide taking place so clearly, so visibly, so horribly, day in, day out, if we don't wake up and realize that these institutions are not fit for purpose, they are not going to stop genocide. And they're never going to be doing that. They are, in reality, in practice, they are tools of colonialism. And, you know, they have never meant to do that. Their whole infrastructure, veto system, etc., etc., is all fixed not to take any action or to stop any genocidal act. If they can't do it right now, in the way that you're visibly seeing it, and as Steve said, you know, overwhelming majority of the global community sees it and urges and wants this to stop, and they're not able to do that, then we need to be, you know, this should be a wake-up call for us, that if we want a future for the globe, for the world, to be in a position to stop this sort of barbaric activities, then we have to bring a change. The system that we have in place right now is not going to be fit for purpose. It's not going to be fixed by doing a petition or two or three or demonstrations or not. I'm not against any of this. We are all involved in this day in, day out to bring more awareness. But I think already the awareness is there. If that awareness is not going to graduate to the level that we see that we need to bring a change in the international structures that are supposed to save us at these horrible hours, then we are fooling ourselves and we are fooling the international community, and we are endangering the future of globe.
Indeed. Well, you mentioned the word wake-up call, and Steve Bell, I can't help to wonder who that should be addressed to, except for the U.S., when you have Washington being the only country that vetoed the U.N. ceasefire resolution. And oddly enough, in a sense, and I'm not too sure what the motivation was for them to introduce a resolution in the U.N. calling for a ceasefire, albeit with preconditions. What do you make of that, that the U.S. to be the only country to have done that?
Well, I think, as I said, the United States desperately wants to reassert its power, having taken a setback in Ukraine. And that's why it's determined to get what it sees as a victory for Israel. It cannot, it believes it can, that a ceasefire would be a setback for the Netanyahu government. It understands that. So the United States is trying to formulate a position where it says there will be a temporary ceasefire, which would lead to all captives being released. But the facts of the matter are the United States is engaging in these kind of contortions because the Israeli government and the United States have different war aims. The Israeli government wants to drive the Palestinians out of Gaza and to maintain a permanent occupation. The United States wants to get an agreement which will allow for some sort of kind of Palestinian administration in Gaza and the agreement of the Arab states who are allied to the United States. So there are differences, and that's why there is some tension between them. We know that the United States is pressing on for a type of ceasefire. And we know that Benny Gantz, the Israeli minister this week, said that there were promising signs. So there is obviously something substantial underway in these negotiations, which are being mediated by Qatar, Egypt and others. But nevertheless, there is this tension in the war aims, and until that is resolved, and until the United States puts real pressure upon Israel to settle, then the war will continue.
Okay, this failure, as you mentioned, Massoud Shajara, of the international organizations, and I believe you're referring to the UN, I'm guessing, in this case in point, it's not going to get solved. Right? I mean, if there's anything that you may know that shows that it's going to, then maybe you can tell us. We're looking at another scenario that's been unfolding, and that's inside of occupied Palestine in the occupied West Bank. A Gaza genocidal war hopefully will come to an end at some point, but the way that it comes to an end is going to be reflective of how what's going to happen there in occupied West Bank. That fire needs to be put out before it turns into what the Gaza Strip has turned into. What do you think needs to be done here in order to prevent that from happening?
I think, first of all, we all agree that this didn't start on 7th of October. This has been going on for a very long time. And what is happening now is the ultimate scenario of a Zionism and the policies of ethnic cleansing the Palestinians and occupying and taking over their land. And so really what we're talking about here is that if international community, if the world community allows this genocide to trickle down and then no one be punished, no price paid by those who committed this and those who made it possible, then this world will become a very horrible place to live in. And I think that realization is needed for us to take the first step to say that we need some fundamental change. I don't think tomorrow we're going to have another United Nations set up, somewhere else or next door. But the fact is this, that we need to think. This is the time to think forward. The policies that we have had in past of trying to bring tranquility to the world and saying never again, these sort of United Nations international courts and everything else are incompetent to bring those values. It really is an utterly hollow, empty talk to say never again with these sort of structures, with these sort of institutions, be it the sort of UN or international court, EU or OIC, they all are not fit for purpose. And if we are unable to think beyond these institutions for creating a society that will be fit for purpose for our next generations, then we are failing. And those who are dying innocently, day in, day out, are dying in vain. Nothing is going to come out of their suffering and their death.